What's the biggest thing holding you back from a seven-figure recruitment business? It's not your market, and it's not your work ethic. It's actually the hidden roadblocks in your business that you don't even realize are there. That's why we created the Seven-Figure Freedom Scorecard. It's a free diagnostic tool that helps recruitment firm owners identify the biggest growth barriers standing in their way. In less than 10 minutes, you'll get a personalized report showing you exactly where you're strong and where you're struggling, and showing you the next steps to build a business that scales predictably without burning out. If you're ready to stop guessing and start growing, then take the free assessment now at recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard.
No, I don't think AI can replace relationships. And I think being a local specialized recruiter and having a big network and having a good reputation, there's always going to be people, I think, that are going to just say, hey, who do you know that's trustworthy and that does a good job?
There's never a perfect time to start your own business. James Cairn quit his job with a one-year-old at home, another baby on the way, no clients, no local network, and no backup plan.
I woke up at like 1 a.m. and I was like, I'm quitting tomorrow. I'm quitting my job. I'm ready to do this. I had $30,000 in cash. That was it. My wife didn't work.
Before getting into recruitment, James did everything right on paper. He earned his CPA, worked in Big Four audit, and built a solid corporate career across SEC reporting, FP&A, and controller roles. But in 2014, he walked away from stability to start the CSP Group, a boutique search firm focused exclusively on finance and accounting talent in the St. Louis market. The first 7 years were tough. He placed only a handful of candidates, borrowed money from family, and came close to quitting more than once.
First year was really tough. I ended up placing some people that weren't even in my niche. I just marketed them because I knew they were really hard to find. And I think I placed three people the first year. I had to borrow money.
The turning point came when he decided that there was no plan B.
I remember I was sitting on my back porch. It was like, it's a nice night of summertime. I was sitting there and I was thinking about this plan B. And then it just suddenly occurred to me like, hey, there is no plan B. Like, okay, forget about the plan B and just do the plan A.
From that moment on, momentum followed, and the CSP Group grew into a trusted partner for middle market companies, placing senior staff to CFOs. James is one of our clients here at Recruitment Coach, so I've had a front row seat to watch his journey unfold.
Some searches, I won't even give them the option of, you know, contingent or even contained. It's just like, hey, like they say, how do we work? I'll say, this is how we work. And it's a third up front. That's it. And we're very confident we can fill this. It'd be our top priority.
I'm Mark Whitby, and you're listening to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear what it really takes to commit fully, survive the early grind, and build a recruitment business when failure is not an option. All right, James, great to see you. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me, Mark. I've been really impressed with your program, and it's an honor to be on the podcast.
Thank you for saying that. And I'm really looking forward to this one. So, James, let's start at the beginning. So you're a CPA and you spent years in Big Four audit and then corporate finance roles. How did you end up in recruitment? What made you look at this industry and think, that's what I want to do?
Yeah, good question. I got my degree in accounting, got my CPA license, started working at PwC. So I had a couple years there. At that point, I realized this is not what I want to do, but I had really no idea what to do. And I got recruited from the guy that I went to college with to work for his firm. He'd gone the same path as me, and he'd spent a couple years in Big Four, and then he was a couple years into recruiting. And so I went to work for him. The problem was, it was the spring of 2008 when I got there. I don't know how well I would have done anyway at that time of my life, but I was only there for a few months and then the Great Recession happened. I didn't even place anybody. And then I totally forgot about recruiting. I went on to do some SEC reporting role and some financial planning and analysis for a small public company. And then I landed a job as a controller in St. Louis and was there for about 5 years and really just like trying to figure out what else I could do. And, you know, about that 5-year mark, I started thinking about recruiting again, but this time doing it, I wanted to be my own boss, start my own company. And so I picked up, did some research online. I picked up a book by Steve Finkel.
Oh yeah, that's a good book.
Yeah, Breakthrough, so, right? Well, no, I guess he co-authored with a guy named Larry Noble. So it's called Search and Placement. It's kind of like the foundational book that he put out, and it's basically a handbook. And so I read that thing like my life depended on it. And it was, I mean, it's still to this day, it's the fundamentals are so strong in that book. I highly recommend it. There's some stuff that's outdated, but that gave me the confidence to go out on my own. But it was, in retrospect, it was kind of crazy to think that I could do that, but it worked. So
okay, just back up one step. What, that very first recruitment job, was that where you met Dario Fuhrman?
That's correct.
Okay, got it. And then you referred him to me, and that he's already been on the podcast. That was a fantastic interview. Really, really enjoyed meeting him. So thanks for the intro.
Yeah, so then absolutely.
You read a book by Steve Finkel and decided to start your own recruiting firm with zero agency side experience. That's a pretty bold move. Painting a picture, I think this is 2014, right?
Correct.
Okay. So you obviously have domain expertise because you're a CPA and you have your, you know, corporate track record. But counterbalancing that, your wife is at home, you've got a 1-year-old, and she's pregnant with your second child. Walk me through that decision. Correct. Like, what convinced you this was the right move?
Yeah. Again, kind of crazy in retrospect, but maybe not, because it worked out. But I read that book, and I was reading a lot of like Tony Robbins stuff. And one night, I felt like I was kind of ready. I'd read the book 3 times. I condensed all the notes. I was like, I think I got this, which, I mean, I didn't know anything at that point, basically, in retrospect. But I woke up at like 1 a.m. and I was like, I'm quitting tomorrow. I'm quitting my job. I'm ready to do this. I had $30,000 in cash. That was it. My wife didn't work. And I really didn't know anybody in St. Louis in the business community, because I'm not from here. So. I woke up at 1 a.m. just like wide awake, like, okay, like this feels like the right decision. And I didn't go back to sleep that night at all. And I went into work and I was like, you know, I was kind of miserable there. And I'm like whistling, you know, walking through the hallways and in the best mood ever. And anyway, that's when I turned to my notice and, you know, got started. So.
All right. Well, that's a sign you're making the right decision, right? If you're whistling when you think about it, that's awesome.
For sure.
So you didn't really have many contacts in the St. Louis market. You had 30K in the bank, which we always tell people, like, you need a buffer. You need to have like enough runway to basically pay your living expenses for a few months until you get up and running. But yeah, I mean, that's not much of a buffer, right? That's, I don't know what your living expenses are, but that's not going to last forever. So you kind of needed to make something happen. So what was that first year, you know, 18 months like?
Yeah, the first year was really tough. I ended up placing some people that weren't even in my niche. I just marketed them because I knew they were really hard to find. And I think I placed 3 people the first year. I had to borrow money from my father-in-law, which was very unpleasant.
Ooh, and then I had the last person you want to borrow from, right?
I know. Yeah. And then I borrowed money from my uncle at one point. But then about that 18-month mark, I started consistently placing people. And then the year after that, suddenly I had, you know, a lot of cash and just, you know, a lot of momentum. So.
Okay. All right. Awesome. So this is what, like a 2-year, 3-year ramp up before you really had momentum and you had good cash flow. Is that accurate?
I'd say 2 years. Yeah.
Okay. So 2 years to really kind of get the momentum going. A couple of times you're running out of money, you had to borrow. That must have been humbling and kind of scary. Like, how close did you get to calling it quits? Or was that never an option? Like, you were going to make this work no matter what?
Yeah, I came pretty close. At one point, I reached out to another guy that did recruiting here, same kind of practice, and talked to him about working for him. And then a couple months later, I don't know, I made a couple placements and I remember I was sitting on my back porch. It was like, it's a nice night of summertime. I was sitting there and I was thinking about this plan B. And then it just suddenly occurred to me, like, hey, you know, it was like, I was talking to myself, you know, it's like, there is no plan B. Like, okay, forget about the plan B and just do the plan A, because I was so worried that it wouldn't work out that I always kind of had one foot out the door. And when that happened, things really started to change at that point. I just forgot about, you know, yeah.
That makes sense. Like, being fully committed, like burning the boats where this is going to happen. So looking back at that period where you went from like really, it was really tough to things started clicking together. What do you think was the difference? What caused things to start working for you and gaining momentum?
I think just being in the market and learning, I did have the CPA license and a controller background to give me some credibility with clients, but I think I still didn't really know anything. I'd only worked at a few companies, and just interviewing a lot of candidates from a lot of different companies in one local market, I started to piece together, like, here's the landscape here, here's who's in demand, you know, and here's who pays less than, you know, one company to another. And when I see a candidate now, I know, like, wow, this, you know, I've done a search like this, it's super hard to find, you know, I was unsuccessful trying to find somebody. So now if I stumble upon this person, it's like, I can pick up the phone and market them. And that's really, you know, that's just proactively recruiting over a period of time and building up a pipeline. And then also, you know, marketing candidates as a way to get into companies. The volume just started to pick up, and, you know, I was placing people very regularly at that point. So
fantastic. Yeah, I think people underestimate how tough this business is actually to, you know, to do, right? And until you get into it, it's definitely not easy. And even when you are very good at what you do, there's still potential for setbacks, disappointments, things not going your way, which I think that's what messes with people's heads more than anything is, like, you can do everything right. You can, like, you know, the accounting and finance market inside out. That was your background. So you've got that. And then you're building your process. You're good at what you do. You're good at identifying candidates, making placements. So you can do everything right and still have the rug pulled out from underneath you. And a lot of people can't deal with that kind of level of constant uncertainty and disappointment. Apart from sitting on your back porch on a summer's day and kind of giving yourself a pep talk and deciding there is no plan B, where do you think that resilience or that grit comes from, James? Like, you know, where you just were absolutely determined to make this work, and ultimately it did.
I think it was just the pressure of, like, supporting a family, you know, that was a huge factor, knowing they were depending on me. And then also knowing, like, I really did not want to, I don't want to work for anybody. Like, I don't, you know, maybe I couldn't, I don't know if I ever could again, you know. I'm just not that kind of, I've always been like that. Yeah. Even in school, it was like, I just wanted to figure it out on my own, you know? So I didn't want to listen to the teachers.
I think you and Which I have really quite dumb, a lot in common. But I'm totally the same. Look, entrepreneurship is not the easy road. It's definitely not, I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, but if you have a certain, you know, if that's the way you're wired, then, and once you get that taste of success, I can't imagine ever going back to working for someone else. And I was the same in school. Like I had trouble focusing and paying attention. I was always getting in trouble for that. So at what point did you hire your first team member, Mark?
Yeah, so I hired Mark in 2020. He was doing some part-time stuff, helping out a little bit in 2020, and then I hired him at the end of the year. And there was a period of time, you know, after I became successful and was, you know, consistently billing and had some money saved up, I really didn't like that was just I just know I needed to do that and get into a better school district for my kids. And at that point, I didn't really know like what was next, you know, like it was I never thought about the next step. And then I was always reluctant to hire somebody. I didn't think I'd be a good boss, you know.
Why did you think
I knew Mark, you know? Because I'm not very good at being disciplined and following a routine, and I think you need to have that. I think you're much better off doing that. And I just thought it'd be, you know, too crazy for somebody to come in and be like, you know, I can't believe I'm working for this guy. He's all over the place, basically. So
okay, all right, yeah. Interesting. Actually, do you know what? I feel like there's a whole chapter we need to talk about with Mark and how you've really like 1 + 1 = 3 and how you've really scaled things in terms of revenue from there. So let me just back up a second, because I feel like we've talked about the mindset aspect of getting the business off the ground, but I'd like to get more tactical. And the reason is I feel like there's a lot of people who might be listening who are either in that startup phase themselves, or they are in a slump and they need to rebuild things kind of from scratch again. And so looking back, or I guess another way of putting it, if you were coaching yourself, you know, at that point where you're trying to really make something happen, can you just break down a little bit, like what were the specific things that you implemented that that were effective?
I think slowing down and creating processes for sure. You know, that was huge. Forgetting about the fee too, just focusing on customer service, you know, the client side and candidate side, just like, how can I help you? You know, and Mark really like pointed that out, because I think bringing somebody on that wasn't so tied to, you know, he was on a salary, so he had a different mindset, and you know, we're pretty close, so we're able to talk openly about everything, and he was able to like calm me down a little bit. And so the emotional kind of roller coaster really went away, you know, at that point of having a different perspective and just focusing on, hey, like what works, and just keep doing that, don't worry about the results. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Okay. So the theme that's coming through is focus on the process and not the outcome, right? And then the results will take care of themselves, kind of thing. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, do the right thing with the people you're dealing with, and don't worry about getting paid. And it always works out better that way, you know, in the long run. So
absolutely. I subscribe to that philosophy for sure. But then, so you mentioned building process, like slowing down, building process. Can you give me an example of a process that you built that has led to revenue?
Yeah. A huge improvement on, like, one of the problems I had was candidates were not very responsive even after I talked to them, you know. So it's like I didn't really have much of a pipeline. I felt like I was starting from scratch every time I got a search. And so, you know, and I guess on the client side a little bit too, just developing those relationships. So we slowed down and said, okay, well, what makes sense with the candidates? And it really was more of like a multi-step process where you get in front of them, you know, multiple times, build that relationship and, you know, some trust and some goodwill. And now when we have a search, I mean, the vast majority of the time now, we don't even have to go out, because we're local and specialized, you know, we have such a big pipeline of candidates. We don't have to go out and like go on LinkedIn very often. We usually just go straight to our pipeline, and we know, you know, we can sort the candidates by their by their salary. You know, if they're accounting or finance or M&A or tax, just go to that file, sort by salary, and then they're responsive now. I can get a hold of that pretty much everybody, you know, and they'll give me some feedback, and you know, we'll have candidates right away. So that was okay. That was big. Yeah.
So break that down for me a little more. So you obviously there was this process of market mapping and building that database, but what was the difference in responsiveness? Like, why do you feel that candidates are more responsive to you now than they were then? Listen, having a ChatGPT license for your team is great, but it is not enough. ChatGPT requires you to stop what you're doing, switch windows, copy information, and ask it to do something. AI agents are different. They're built into your workflow and they take action automatically. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM with built-in AI agents working for you around the clock. Their encoding agent structures your data. Their job change alert agent monitors your database for opportunities. Their note-taking agent captures conversations and updates your CRM. This isn't about working harder. It's about letting AI handle the busy work so you can focus on relationships. To see it in action, go to recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. Most recruiters try to convince new clients they're credible on the call, but the best time to establish trust is long before the sales call even starts. That's exactly why we've launched a new service here at Recruitment Coach called Trusted Voice Video. In just 30 minutes a month, we help you to create 30 days of professional video content. No scripts, no awkward performances. You simply show up for a guided conversation around topics you already know inside out. We'll tell you exactly what to talk about, what equipment you need, and help you feel confident on camera. We'll make sure you look and sound great, even if you hate seeing or hearing yourself on video. And we handle everything else. You'll get to work directly with my colleague, Sanjay. He's the guy who produces this podcast you're listening to right now, as well as my own LinkedIn videos. If you want clients showing up already pre-sold on working with you, book a free video content strategy call at recruitmentcoach.com/video. What are you doing differently?
Yeah, so at first I would just get on the phone with them and spend too much time on the phone, ask a bunch of questions. It's like, okay, I'll call you if I got something, you know? And so now it's more, it just seemed like it was all about me, you know? And so the first step now is all about the candidate. Like, tell me about yourself. What are you looking for? We really don't even get into their experience because I can see a profile and know in 5 seconds what kind of candidate they are, what they do, you know? So it's more, that's the first step. Second step is, all right, we're going to work with you to build out a presentation, a talent profile. And so when we come across something, you know, we can put you in front of them and generate more interest. And so we use it in three ways. So one is, and we'll go over, and by the way, we'll go over this with them, like on a Teams call. You can look at the profile together and walk through, and I'll give them recommendations on, you know, strengths and achievements. And so really being more consultative with the candidate. And so, you know, so we'll use that. So we'll say, look, if we have a job that you're interested in, you do some research, you say, yeah, I want to explore that. We'll send your resume, and then we'll send that talent profile to really paint you in the best light possible right off the bat with the client and get them interested. Two, it's going to go on our website. So not everybody can do this. If you're like a national, if you have like a national footprint, you know, or you're really spread out, like it might not work very well. But for us, since we're local and specialized, you know, we'll go to, we have our candidate database. Anybody we've talked to over the last 12 months that we feel is fee worthy and represents us well, we put their, and it's all, you know, confidential, of course, but we put their profile on our website. Employers can go and they can search by salary, staff level, you know, industry experience, if they're accounting or tax or M&A, whatever. And we get some pretty good traffic coming from clients in our network. They'll reach out and say, I want to talk to this specific candidate. And then the third way is it's a unique URL. So we can send out that profile and market them. Whereas in the past, and that also helps us because in the past, you know, when you NPC somebody, you're going to go and you're going to type something up on them, and you're going to spend half an hour maybe if you see something. And sometimes you're just too busy. You're working on searches. You're like, oh man, I want to market this guy, but I don't really have time to go. But it's just like one other thing you got to do, and you end up just leaving money on the table. So by having them fill out that talent profile and having it ready to go right away, and also, you know, it's on the website, we can just get their URL and send it out to people. That's generated like a third of our placements.
Just from doing that
talent profile. So, yeah.
So, okay. Thanks for sharing that. And I think what you've highlighted, the before and the after, is fantastic. And the before is pretty typical how a lot of recruiters operate. It's more transactional. It's more like interrogating someone, asking a bunch of questions so that you can extract in, like, you've got a short amount of time, you want to extract kind of the key information that you need from them. But it sounds like you've now gone to a much more consultative approach, which is about how can you help them? And you've actually built this value added, like, that's, it's interesting because the recruiters I train focus on differentiation, but usually it's focused on clients, right? Like, how can we have a value prop that's differentiated for clients? But you're actually also offering a very different service to candidates and giving them something unique as well. So that's really interesting. So let me get this straight. So you've got on your website, you're actually featuring or showcasing your candidates. So clients can actually browse through your, can they see your whole database or only a selection of the candidates?
Yeah, it's not all of them. Sometimes people don't want to fill it out, or they're super paranoid about, you know, their employer finding out or something, or we just, maybe they're like, you know, maybe we can place this person, you know, but I don't know if we want to put them on the website. But yeah, it's everybody that we feel, you know, is be worthy and represents us well over the last 12 months. And so we'll go back every 12 months and like take them out and re-qualify them. But yeah, and I think it's a value add for clients too, because, you know, they know, like, a lot of these people, they only want to work on it. They don't want to pay a fee, which, understandable. They want to see if they can do something on their own, and they can go here to the website and just search for free. It's a not, I don't know if they're there or not, you know, so they can go and take a look and see if we've got somebody. So trying to get that message across a little bit more to clients as well. But I also think having the candidate put in some effort, you know, and actually fill out that form gets just psychologically, I think it gets their buy-in to, you know, and thinking about us a little bit more. So when we do call them, it's, I know this guy, you know, they put a lot of time and effort, not a lot, but enough to, you know, to think it's worth a call back. So
that is huge, actually, is because they're involved in the process, you're getting them, then they have a higher commitment to you as well, right? And so, yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So that's really cool. Thanks for sharing that, that whole aspect. So there was something else I was going to ask you. Oh, by the way, you may or may not be aware of this. You can actually track who's visiting your website. I don't know if you ever thought about doing that. There's software where, like, we use it. So people visit our website, and then we get a Slack message with their LinkedIn profile and kind of like name and email address and all that stuff that you could follow up if you wanted to.
Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah. I'm aware that I need to implement that for sure. That could be big.
So, okay. So you've built some really brilliant processes. Are there any other kind of, like, thinking about the 80-20 rule, any other key things that helped you to really start building momentum?
I think authenticity too. Just, you know, probably like most people in this business, or maybe in general entrepreneurs, it's like a, you know, there's this complex where, you know, you feel like you're not, it's an imposter syndrome, you know? And so going and trying to, you know, work on my voice and change it to be this super professional voice, like, never really worked very well to me. I just seemed like I was too uptight and just think in my head, thinking about that all the time. And when I get into, you know, like there's periods where I do really well, and then sometimes I'm a little bit off or whatever, but when I'm doing really well, I'm just being myself, you know? And so I think that was another, huge realization is like, hey, like I'm not, you know, some real polished sales guy, but I know this niche pretty well, and I can add some value to these people and help them, you know? And so that's been a big game changer for me.
100%. I think that is so valuable that for people to consider is, I think we're all like that, right? We want to project a certain image of ourselves, or like a sort of perfect version of ourselves, in business. And that's really hard to maintain. And I also think it puts a barrier between you and a genuine connection with the other person. And what I found actually has been really since I launched this podcast, James, is I was a bit like that as well. Like if I think back, like even, you know, 7-8 years ago, where I didn't want like clients or, you know, the people in the market who I serve or who I want as customers to really know my weaknesses, my vulnerabilities, my, you know, mistakes or whatever. And what I've found through doing this podcast is that it's impossible to talk for this long. Like if someone's listening to for an hour, your real self is going to come out, and it's just too much effort to try and hold it in, if that makes sense, and try and like say everything perfect and not let slip anything that might like to overthink about what you're saying and how will people interpret that. And so you just kind of need to relax into it and accept that, like, I'm probably going to say some dumb stuff. I'm probably going to mess up my words sometimes. I'm probably going to, like, it's okay. I can just relax and be myself. And what I've found has happened is that now maybe some people have been turned off by the real me, and that's possible, but then probably they would have never bought from me anyway, so it doesn't matter. Whereas the people who, you know, actually like the real me are more likely to gravitate towards me anyway. So it kind of filters, it's like a filtering system that the right people who I'm meant to work with are going to accept me. And the people who don't, you know, like me for whatever reason, you know, they don't matter anyway, ultimately. So how did you get to this point where you're confident in yourself?
Yeah, I think it's just like years of doing it and realizing, like, you know, it used to be if I didn't have anything going on, like I'd place somebody and I would think after every placement, like, I'm never going to place somebody again. Somehow I'd be like, oh, like, how am I going to do this again? You know, but then just having the evidence of like, look at this, you know, track record. I think that helped a lot, and just becoming more confident and knowing my niche. You know, the other thing about being authentic, I think, is like, you're not trying to control everything. Cause early on I would really try to like manipulate the I was like, I wanted to get the fee, you know, I try to like manipulate it. And so I always kind of thought like, if I am consulting with a client or pushing back on a client or candidate, you know, there's a difference between doing that because you want a certain outcome and doing it because you know what you're talking about. And, you know, there's some of the best placements I've made have been, they weren't going to work out. And I've had to like, really like tell people, you know, why this is a bad idea to not take this opportunity or to not hire this candidate, end up being great for them, you know? And I think just having that, you know, just being honest, being authentic, helps with that, your ability to consult with people too, you know, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So actually we've ended up coming back around to the point where you hired Mark and you had this kind of shift in the way that you're approaching things of not worrying as much about the fee, but focusing on how can I help? Can you talk a little bit more about, well, first of all, you said you already knew Mark. How did you know him?
Yeah, so we grew up together. We met. I'm from a small town in Florida called Baldwin. It's outside of Jacksonville, and he lived down the street. So we've been friends since, you know, like seventh grade. So
oh, cool.
And you know, he didn't have a background. He's a former Marine. He did 911 dispatch for like over a decade, but you know, super high integrity. Trusted him, you know, a lot, and I think that's. I don't know if I ever would have hired anybody, you know, otherwise. So it's been good, but that's how we knew each other.
Okay, fantastic. And so was there a particular moment where you realized like we need to stop worrying about the fee and just focus on like doing things right and the fees will take care of themselves? Like what did that evolution actually look like?
I think it was a process, you know, I don't know if there was a one moment, but just it's became kind of obvious. And then just, you know, just putting our head down and coming up with like, what are the things we're supposed to be doing, you know, and then doing those things consistently. So, you know, writing them down, looking back like, hey, what worked in the past? How do we get this placement? You know, how do we get this client? And then just, you know, repeat. So.
Okay, so a couple of questions. One is, what influence did Mark have on this process? You mentioned, obviously, he doesn't come from a recruiting background, so that's both a disadvantage and an advantage, I guess. The disadvantage is there is a learning curve, but the advantage is someone maybe brings fresh ideas or different perspective on things. What was it in him, his background, his mindset, whether it's 911 dispatch or being a Marine or just something about his character that complemented the way that you were working?
Yeah, I think it's his character and just his behavioral profile, basically. I mean, he's very conscientious and detail oriented, process oriented, you know. Like that guy's inbox is empty at the end of every day, you know, whereas mine is, I'm getting there, but like it was crazy at first. So just realizing the value, because I was always, I don't have time to do this admin stuff, you know, but realizing the value in being organized and staying on top of things. And so he just cannot work the way I work. And I can't really work the way he works either, but I'm getting there, you know, and it's like, it's been a huge, huge help. So, you know.
Okay. Interesting. You mentioned also he's on a salary and you feel like that changed the incentives and therefore the way that he thought about the business. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think not having the pressure, you know, and him, I think him seeing too, like he probably had more confidence in me than I had in myself, you know, so just a different mindset, you know, and just more steady and building than, Where's the next fee? You know, so working on the longer term infrastructure and processes and, day to day kind of admin, that stuff really adds up. You know, it's pretty critical. So
this is maybe a good point to ask you about the structure of your business. Is it just the two of you or is there anyone else?
Yeah, it's just the two of us, but we're getting to the point now. I'm going to hire somebody else soon. And the plan is to try to replicate, like build out our model here in St. Louis and then replicate that in other cities. Cause I do think that, you know, you've got some amazing content on your, in your program and some really interesting guests that have all kinds of insights into all these aspects of how technology is changing the recruiting industry. And we certainly need to get more, we need to leverage AI more for sure, but feel like we got pretty good processes, but we definitely need to leverage that more. But I think at the end of the day, I don't know, you know, I don't think AI can replace relationships. And I think being a local specialized recruiter, you know, and having a big network and having a good reputation, there's always going to be people, I think, that are going to just say, hey, who do you know, you know, business owners talking to each other, you know, CFOs talking to each other, who do you know that's trustworthy and that does a good job that we can use to, you know, find somebody good for our team? And so I think just staying with that kind of approach in the long run is going to be a good strategy. And so we're gonna hire, you know, another recruiter or two, and then try to put somebody in I'm doing all the BD right now, and, you know, on the sales side, but putting somebody there and, you know, having them do our model and then replicating that in other cities. So I'm in St. Louis, Mark's in San Diego. We get some jobs out there, but mostly we're in St. Louis. So going to try to, you know, build out San Diego. There's an interest in the Denver market as well. So that's really the vision, is try to get a few different cities going, and just, again, local specialized. So,
all right. Awesome. I love it. So are you both running a full desk, or are you more the client facing and Mark is more the delivery?
Yeah, we're both running a full desk, but it's just worked out now where, you know, it's mostly Mark's mostly recruiting, and I'm mostly doing sales, just because I've been here a lot longer and got a lot more connections. It's just kind of worked out that way. So,
okay, cool. So let's delve into the local angle. Like, you've already touched on it, but what do you feel is the advantage of being the local specialist?
Just the knowledge, you know, you have of companies in town, you know, again, the culture, who pays under market, who pays competitively. You know, give you an example of this. We had a client that we placed a lot of people with. I think at the time, maybe we'd placed like 8 people with them over a few years. And they looked at us as like just a contingent, you know, maybe lower to mid-level kind of firm. And so they decided to, for their CFO search, they wanted to use, you know, a professional, like a executive out of town, you know, big national search firm. And, you know, they're a $300 million a year business. They had a huge problem with their ERP. Nobody could ever get their ERP implementation over the finish line. And they were in food production business. And so it'd been going on for like 9 months. They couldn't find anybody through this firm. And, you know, I ended up talking to them and saying, okay, well, you know, tell me what it is you're looking for. And yeah, I knew exactly where to go. We had a candidate who was from Anheuser-Busch, you know, they're headquartered here. And she was like a VP of finance. She was the co-lead on the largest ever, you know, SAP implementation. So that's what they say anyway, largest global SAP implementation ever, you know, phenomenal finance experience and executive presence and all that stuff. And so it's just like, look, I know somebody because I've, you know, spent years in this market. I know who's just done a big ERP implementation, you know, who's in food production. So if I had to go out to another city and try to find that person, I mean, I would not have found it, you know, so I can see why. And then getting somebody to relocate to St. Louis, you know, from, it's not like a real magnet for, yeah, it's not a super desirable place. I like it, but it's, you know, it's not San Diego, it's not Miami or something like that, or New York. So anyway, I think that's what it is, just the knowledge you acquire. And, you know,
great little case study there. So I believe that position you're talking about, you filled that in like 30 days after the big search firm had failed. And actually, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions about that. But first, just to finish off the local aspect, I agree 100%. Local market knowledge is powerful, but also you can physically go and see people, right? Whether it's clients, candidates, you can meet in person, which I really think is a huge advantage for building relationships, gaining trust, and everything just seems to go everything seems easier after you've met someone in person for the first time, right? So that's hard to replicate nationally. But so you got this client, they gave the role to a big fancy search firm. That company wasn't able to fill it. I think you told me they'd been working on it for 9 months or something, and then you came along and filled it in 30 days. What did that placement unlock for your business? It, like, having had that win where the other company had failed?
Yeah, that that helped us a lot, because not only just that was our first big like CFO placement, you know, and then we were able to go and, you know, they were a referral for us, and that helped unlock a few other pretty big CFO placements just from that one, you know, having that like social proof, you know. And so, because we'll get calls sometimes, and in the past it was like, well, you know, can you give me a reference? You know, what kind of experience do you have at this level? And I knew, to me, those are easier searches than dealing with the lower level candidates, if for whatever reason. But now it's, you know, we're always, every time we've had a CFO search, it's like, wow, this is amazing, the quality of candidates we've gotten in this amount of time, you know, and getting referrals from that. So
this is something really important I'd love to highlight is, well, first of all, it's actually easier to, in some ways, not in all ways, but in some ways, it filling the more senior roles is easier. And the crazy thing is, though, the reward is much bigger. So it's like a bigger fee for an easier search. But also the domino effect you just described, like getting the first one is the hard part, because if the client says, so how many CFO placements have you made? And you're like, well, none, then it's hard, like that's harder, right? So, but once you get that first opportunity and you do a great job, then the next one's easier and the next one's even easier. And not saying you're going to win them all. You never win them all, but then you just have that track record that gives you the buyer confidence that you're going to be able to deliver, right? So I think that's a key turning point. So thinking about I think you now consistently beat larger accounting and finance firms in your market. What do you think is the reason that you win those pitches?
I think we're better at the matching game, for whatever reason. I think we're better at the matching game. The other thing is, I keep going back and forth on this, but I don't really like, if somebody's a maybe, you know, like I don't like to send them out. You know, I think we probably screen too tightly. So I just really want to, you know, I want to give them really good candidates, and I'm just honest with them. You know, hey, look, like if at that point I don't have anybody, say like I don't have anybody I feel like really excited about, but I'll show you who else we got. You know, you still want to deliver something. So that's the approach I take. And I do think the speed is a factor too, you know, if you're competing. So there, yeah, two things there. For, I don't like to compete with another firm on a contingent basis, especially now that we're getting retained work and a lot of, you know, contained, you know, type of engagements as well. So we're doing better at, you know, if we do have to go contingent, we'll tell them like, hey, we're just going to look in our database. We've got somebody, we'll get back to you in a few days. But again, having those candidates be more responsive now, quicker turnaround, constantly adding people proactively to our pipeline, but then knowing how to sell them on, this isn't really in your best interest to put this out to us and another firm, and here's why. You know, we're going to find out about that, and that's going to go on that's going to put your search in a lower category for us as far as like what we're going to focus on, because our chances are lower and we've got people paying us up front. We owe them first, right? They're paying us up front. So why don't you give us, you know, I get it. Sometimes you don't have authorization to do a full retained search because maybe this is a manager level position. You guys only do that for executives or directors or whatever, but you know, give us $5,000 up front and 4 weeks. And I feel pretty confident, because even if we don't fill it within 4 weeks, we've got such a head start on anybody else. You know, we've adjusted, and by then we know, you know, what's going to work and what's not. So if they want to bring in somebody at that point, you know, they're legally and, you know, contractually they can do that, and that's fine. I still feel pretty good about where we're at. And, you know, once we follow the process, it's like, hey, we've done all we can do, you know? So like that's it. So then we can move on to something else. But
okay. I'm really excited to delve into this, James, because it's something you've done a phenomenal job with, is that transition from more mostly contingent work to now you're getting a lot of contained and retained work. So you gave us a taste of the pitch there, but like, what do you think were the key factors that allowed you to make that transition?
Having the option to say no to searches that we, you know, some searches, I won't even give them the option of, you know, contingent or even contained. It's just like, hey, like they say, how do we work? I'll say, this is how we work. And it's a third up front, you know, and then that's it. And we're very confident we can fill this. It'd be our top priority. And so, you know, whereas in the past, it was like, I really want this search. I don't want them to say no. And I would basically push them to a contingent option by giving them options, you know, and that's going to sound better because they don't owe anything up front. So, but yeah, I think just knowing like, hey, like I'm not that excited about this search in the first place. I've got some other stuff I could more easily, you know, more likely make some money on. And so, you know, that's really it. And then just kind of not really caring. Hey, I don't care if we get the search or not, you know?
Okay. This is fantastic. So it's having that genuine walkaway power where the words you use is, I don't care if we win this search or not. Like, how did you get to that mental place though? Where is it just because you're now busy or you've got a lot more demand, you've got more clients. So that gives you the confidence to say, look, this is how we work and be strong with it. Or is there anything else going on here? Like how do you create that confidence?
Well, that's part of it. The other part is that a couple years ago, we decided, yeah, I mean, 3 years ago, like, hey, we're going to follow this process and get really good at the process. So any search that comes along, we're just going to take it. And we got a lot of these like staff accountant, senior accountant searches that were usually, you know, would turn down before and since for sure, because we ended up working on 20 like staff or senior level accounting searches over the span of a few months. And we filled one of them because like those candidates are so like, they're so in demand that when you have a good one, they're already talking to like three other recruiters and they're not really being honest with you half the time. And they're applying to, it's just like a mess. And so it's just, you realize like, it's just the years of doing it, realizing what's worth your time and what's not, you know? So, but then also, like you said, the volume is good enough where we don't really need this one. It's a low probability search, you know? So.
Okay. Got it. So there's a couple of factors there. One is the pain of being burned so many times with like accepting the wrong orders or on the wrong terms and filling one job out of 20, which makes you think, man, I don't want to do that anymore. That's really sucks. And then it's also now you're at a stage where you're busy enough that you're not operating out of desperation. You don't need every client to say yes. And ironically, when you can arrive at that place where you don't need the business, then suddenly it's so much easier to close. People want to work with you. I think it really comes across non-verbally when you're detached from the outcome. Like obviously you'd love to work with them, but it's not, if you don't win it, then you're still going to be fine, right? Nothing, you know, you're not desperate for that work. I think that really comes across in your demeanor and everything.
People can sense if you're desperate or you're confident, you know, I think they can sense that pretty quickly if you're trying to sell them on something, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly. And then you touched on, but I'd love to hear more detail around talking to them about why using multiple recruiters is actually going to go against them.
Yeah. I mean, specifically, you know, in the past we were, hey, can you do this on like a handshake deal? Just give us the exclusive. And they're like, yeah, no problem. And then the third person we call, you know, we find out is somebody else called them or two other firms called them about this. I think it's a bad. So one is it's not going to make us work harder to compete with that other firm, you know? So that's a misconception right away. It's not good to have different multiple firms compete because they're going to step down instead of step up. So there's that too. It's a bad candidate experience, you know, getting multiple calls. But yeah, it's just those are the main things. And paying us up front, we're obligated to you, you know, like that's a big factor.
And so when it comes to towards the end of the client meeting, or whether that's over Teams or in person, then how do you seal the deal? Like the client says, so how do you work? And you say what? Like, what's your explanation for how you recommend moving forward?
Yeah. So we'll just say, look, we want to make this a top priority. And we require $5,000 payment up front. So, 4-week period of exclusivity. If you're not happy after that, you can move on. And that's pretty much it. And we'll send them an email afterwards with these are our options, and then send them like a DocuSign. I mean, I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but
it's pretty low key. It sounds like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a sales guy, you know, I don't know. I guess I am, but I try not to come across like that. So I just really put the ball in the court.
I mean, I think recruiting is selling, but, you're not overselling, I think is what you're saying, right? You're not trying too hard to convince them, which again, it comes back to that being detached from the outcome, ironically works better than being pushy. And so you're not trying to convince anybody, but you're saying, I like the wording we require. And you're saying it in a very matter of fact way. Like this is just the normal, this is everyday normal stuff. This isn't, so we require $5,000 up front, 30 days of exclusivity. And yeah, it's simple. It's not a big pitch. It's just a simple, this is how it works. What's usually their reaction? Do you get any pushback or?
Yeah, sometimes. And it's like, not very often though. And when we do, it's like, okay, I mean, if you guys have already decided you want to go multiple firms on a contingent basis, that's fine. And I do also tell them too, like, all right, I think this is going to take us X amount of time, you know, based on, I can pretty much know like right away whether we got candidates for this search or not in our database. You know, it's like I say, look, it's going to take us, 3-4 days to get back to you with candidates by the time we, you know, pitch it to them and everything, get a hold of them. And so I should have, and at that point, you know, we'll see where we're at. And if we need to go out and do a search on, you know, on LinkedIn or whatever, that'll take us another week and a half, you know, 2 weeks. And so give them a good expectation, but just say, if you just want to do this and we're just, you know, a contingent basis, we'll check our database and that's it. And so they know like, oh, these guys aren't really going to like work on this that hard. So maybe we'll just pay them the $5,000 and have them, you know, really do a good job. So.
Awesome. Yeah. Really, really good. Now your time frame you just shared, that's very quick. Especially for, you know, senior level searches. So that in itself, I think gives you a massive advantage over the big boys, right? Because they just take way longer than that and are more expensive. So this seems like a really great solution. But tell me, if you're delivering the shortlist in 3 or 4 days, has their 5K actually even cleared yet? Like what's the timing of all this? Do you wait for the money to hit your bank account before you start, or how do you handle that?
I mean, we wait for the agreement to be signed. There's a little bit of trust there. Like I've never had anybody, you know, we tell them it's due up front and we get right away. It's like, here's our AP person, give us your ACH information. So
yeah,
we might start it a day or two before we get the, you know, the 5K, but we've never not gotten it, you know, within a few days. So
fantastic.
I'm not too worried about it. Yeah. As long as they sign that agreement, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
What percentage of the work you're doing now is on a engaged basis?
About 40%. I mean, I still like contingent, you know, having that pipeline of candidates is huge. You know, again, going back to the local and specialized, like it's huge, but, you know, for searches, you know, that we're going to have to put some effort into. Yeah. We want that up front. So it's about 40 retained and contained about 40%.
Yeah. Wait, contained and retained together are 40%?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Of revenue or of order, number of orders?
I don't know. That's a good question. Okay. Probably, probably number of orders.
Okay. Got it.
And we really, like, that's just in the last couple years where we really started, like, being able to sell that a lot easier. So
that's interesting. Because what you might find is if 40% of your orders are committed, then it's actually a higher percentage of your revenue, because on those committed searches, your fill rate's going to be really high, right? Whereas your fill rate on a contingent order is going to be lower. So you might find that as a proportion of your total revenue, actually there's more coming from those retained ones.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Awesome. So James, tech stack, what are the tools that you can't live without?
Database, obviously.
Database?
PC Recruiter.
PCR,
yeah. So I've always had it. It's super customizable. You know, I've been curious about other ones, but it works really well for us, and we've done a lot of work in it, so it'd just be too much of a hassle to change. I don't even know what else is out there, but it's been good for us. It talks to our website, and then really just LinkedIn. We use, of course, LinkedIn Recruiter, but then we have something called Career Builder. I'm sorry, no. Career search. I'm struggling with the name of it. Career search. I think it's, I don't know. I got to look this up real quick. But yeah, it's Career Shift. I'm sorry. Yeah, Career Shift. So it's pretty good. And nobody really knows about it. Actually, Dario is the one who told me about it. But somebody that he worked with actually created this. It's just like a huge database. I mean, you can go in, you can type in company names by industry. The information is not quite as accurate as like a Zoom Info or something, but it's pretty accurate, so you can go and you can search by title, and we've done searches just in Career Shift and gotten some pretty good results. You can look at open jobs. It'll show, like, it'll do an aggregate of all the job postings. You can look at people by title, by company, different companies. Crunchbase is another one that we use just for research. So you're familiar with that?
Yeah, I am. In fact, something I meant to ask you, because I think you do a lot of work with PE-backed companies and scale-ups and that type of thing. Do you get info from Crunchbase on which companies are growing, or how do you use Crunchbase?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it does a phenomenal job of, I don't know how they get all this info, but a lot of like private equity, venture capital, if they're Series A, Series B, Series C, like where they're located, all that stuff. Like, it's a pretty good tool. And both Career Shift and Crunchbase are super cheap. I mean, it's like less than $1,000 a year, for both of those. So
awesome.
Those
now
are good.
Career Shift give you the contact info? Because that was what I was going to ask. Like, if you do a LinkedIn recruiter search, how are you getting, if you don't want to just in-mail someone, how are you getting the emails, the phone numbers, the other contact info for those candidates?
Yeah, Career Shift. Yeah, it does a pretty good job. Again, it's not as accurate as maybe Zoom Info or something, but it's probably 70% accurate, I would guess. So it's pretty good. So yeah, we'll go, and if we need to, we need to hunt somebody down, we'll look them up on Career Shift, and it usually works out. So
okay, fantastic. Might I suggest that you take a look at the Clay course that we've just launched, that you, because you're a member, you have free access to that. Don't forget, because as far as getting accurate contact details for way less than you'd get from Zoom Info or a tool like that, Clay is phenomenal at that. That's kind of like where it comes into its own, is the data, building data sets and data enrichment. But look, is there anything that you wanted to talk about today that we haven't covered yet?
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, thank you for having me on. Hopefully this is helpful to, some of those recruiters out there who are, struggling and trying to, to really grow and, have some perspective. So I think I think that covers most of it. And again, I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, definitely helpful. And not just for recruiters who are struggling, but for all owners and recruiters, if you think about it, in fact, not just the mindset stuff and the pitching, you know, getting a deposit, that was really, really valuable. The thing I loved especially was the way that you work with candidates and build those profiles, and you have a very innovative system for candidate marketing. So that was super cool as well. James, thank you very much. That was fun.
Yeah, likewise, Mark. Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. Awesome. What were your top takeaways from that interview? If you're watching on YouTube, please let me know in the comments. Here are a few of mine. Number one, focus on getting searches exclusively. James moved from fully contingent to around 40% retained because he stopped trying to persuade clients and he got comfortable walking away. I love that he presents the engagement fee very calmly and matter-of-factly. He says something along the lines of, "This is how we work. We require $5,000 up front and 4 weeks exclusivity. There's no big pitch and no over-explaining." Takeaway number two is don't wait for a job order to start recruiting and don't default to LinkedIn when the search comes in. James does the work up front. He stays local, specialized, and in regular contact with candidates and really takes a consultative approach with them so that when a role opens up, he already knows who to call and they actually call him back. Takeaway number three, I love how James creates talent profiles. He features detailed, anonymized profiles for vetted local candidates and publishes them on his website so employers can browse real talent in real time. That visibility has become a clear differentiator and a direct source of placements. Just one more thing before I go. I pour enormous time and energy into producing this podcast. So if you feel like you got value from this episode, please do take a moment to give us a review on Apple or Spotify. It really helps us to be discovered by other recruiters.